Hello there. Today is Monday, August 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, dozens, including women and children, have been killed in a suicide bombing at a wedding party in Afghanistan. With volatile stock markets and economist warnings, President Trump says the U.S. is doing just fine.
Honestly, I'm prepared for everything. I don't think we're having a recession.
Also ahead, the deceased rock star whose guitar just sold at auction for over $1 million. It's all on today's International Edition. Authorities in Afghanistan say the death toll has risen to more than 63, with at least 183 people injured following an overnight suicide bombing at a packed wedding hall in the capital of Kabul. The victims were mostly members of the minority Shiite Hazara community. Afghan's Interior Ministry confirming women and children were among the victims. The blast occurred just before midnight on Saturday, and police and ambulances were quickly rushing to the site to get victims to local hospitals. President Ashraf Ghani condemned the attack, saying he did summon an extraordinary meeting to review security lapses. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, political science professor and South Asia expert at Indiana University, about what effect it might have on the ongoing talks with the Taliban.
First, of course, this is a colossal tragedy, and it underscores the fact that ISIS has a foothold in Afghanistan, which is deeply disturbing for the entire subcontinent, given the presence of very large Muslim communities in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and even a sizable Muslim community in Sri Lanka. So the ripple effects will be felt throughout the region, quite apart from the tragedy that has again befallen Afghanistan. And on the talks themselves, my suspicion is the U.S. interlocutors will bring up this issue. The Taliban will no doubt dissemble and insist that they have nothing to do with ISIS, though one wonders about the credibility of such a claim. After all, they were the ones who nurtured al-Qaeda before 9/11 and refused to hand over Osama bin Laden, despite the insistence of the United States. So consequently, I am somewhat skeptical about anything the Taliban says about ISIS.
What do you know about the relationship between the Taliban and ISIS, if any?
Well, at this point, unfortunately, we have made it so clear to our interlocutors that we are desperate to get out of Afghanistan. And consequently, we may tell the Taliban almost anything about ISIS and warn them about an involvement with ISIS. But they are likely to dissemble, and they are unlikely to give us what is called in the jargon of political science a credible commitment. A commitment that one can take to the bank. And thereby, I am somewhat jaundiced in terms of my view about any claim that the Taliban is likely to make. But it is a matter that we have to raise forthrightly with them.
Are we meeting the United States between the proverbial rock and a hard place, especially when it comes to troop withdrawal from Afghanistan?
We are definitely between a rock and a hard place, and in part this is of our own making, because we made it much too clear to the Taliban that we really are desperate to get out. And they consequently have the upper hand at the moment. After 18 years of war, we are no closer to completely defeating them, and in fact, we may even be worse off. And the president on too many occasions has made clear his interest in getting out of Afghanistan before 2020, maintaining a token force, perhaps some special operations, individuals and groups, and some intelligence assets. And so the Taliban knows that time is on their side, and they can get away with murder, quite literally.
Is there a way out here?
The way out here, that's the subject of a very long conversation. But the immediate issue is to induce Pakistan to end its support for the Taliban. And we have not been very successful in this endeavor and have only pursued it rather half-heartedly. And to also remind the Taliban that if they become hosts to yet another terrorist organization, the U.S., with reluctance, may be forced to come back with its allies, and it will not be pleasant. But I'm not sure that the Taliban genuinely believes that we have the intestinal fortitude to return to Afghanistan after 18 years of being bled, both in terms of blood and treasure.
All right, that's Dr. Sumit Ganguly, science, political science professor and South Asia expert at Indiana University, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump is warning of an economic downturn if he is not reelected. The U.S. marks 400 years since the first Africans arrived in the U.S. Migrants jump off a rescue boat to try to reach an Italian island. And the World Food Program is warning of unprecedented food emergency in Burkina Faso. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. French President Emmanuel Macron hosts his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin later today for a rare visit. Putin is seldom invited by major Western powers for visits at a time of growing tensions, but France believes the arrival of Volodymyr Zelensky as Ukraine's new president could give a new impulse to halting the fighting. Macron will welcome Putin at his official holiday residence in southern France days before he hosts other world leaders, including U.S. President Donald Trump, with a Group of Seven summit Russia was slung or pushed out of what was the G8 in 2014 after it seized Ukraine's Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea, an annexation the international community has deemed illegal. Joining us to talk more about what to expect from this rare visit is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, so what's the motivation behind Macron inviting Putin?
Essentially, Emmanuel Macron has seemed to have gotten the idea that now is the time to make new inroads and give some depth to Franco-Russian relations. There is a feeling that Emmanuel Macron is really the only person with any standing in Europe at the moment. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, is weak. She's a weak government. She's going to leave office in the next few years. The United Kingdom, Boris Johnson, can't speak for Europe, and no one knows how long he will be in the job. And Italy, of course, has, you know, again, has got a political crisis underway. So Emmanuel Macron feels that now is the time, as the strong man, the leader of Europe, he can reach out to Vladimir Putin and talk to him about issues that have really been bogging down the relationship, and in particular, that is Ukraine, Iran, Syria, and trade. And he feels that if he gets Vladimir Putin to his summer holiday residence on the Mediterranean, he'll be able to talk to him and get some sort, he hopes, some sort of agreement to get a dialogue going again about Ukraine, and also possibly to get him to use some sort of influence when it comes to Iran.
What about the nuclear issue? Will that be coming up most likely?
Well, there are several nuclear issues that he will want to be talking to Vladimir Putin about. Emmanuel Macron really wants Vladimir Putin to use his influence with Tehran to prevent any further escalation and to get that JCPOA agreement sort of adhered to try and bring something about there, so that there can be a continued dialogue between Europe and Iran, and also with Russia playing a key role there. Also, of course, the other big nuclear issue at the moment is the nuclear weapons. There is a feeling that someone has to talk to Russia and talk about this INF treaty, this arms control, just being ripped apart before everyone's eyes. The French know very well that this nuclear weapon modernization program is underway, that they have to be back at the negotiating table on that. So that is another big issue. Now, of course, France does have nuclear weapons, And it is a permanent member of the Security Council at the UN. So it feels it has a role. And by talking to Vladimir Putin about these issues may just give some clarity as to which way the future is heading.
And what about the G7, the upcoming G7? I know, obviously, Putin won't be there. Has Macron talked at all about whether or not he plans to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump?
We have no word yet as to whether or not there will be a meeting beforehand, a one-on-one with Donald Trump. But, of course, there will be some sort of sideline, bilateral, but we've got no issues on that. And this is also another reason why Vladimir Putin is being brought to France, if you like, before the G7 at the end of the week. It's a way of saying, well, you might be shunned by others within the international community because of that 2014 seizing of Crimea and Ukraine, and also with the causing the fighting in eastern Ukraine. So there is also this way of, if you bring Vladimir Putin in here, you can talk to him about the same issues you're going to talk about at the G7. And also, Emmanuel Macron will no doubt use that conversation he has with Putin when he's having other discussions later on in the week with other heads of state and government.
What about human rights issues and, of course, the arrests of opponents of the current leadership there in Russia? Do you think that that will come up?
Absolutely. Emmanuel Macron has said that he will bring this up. The French foreign minister has said many times that France is concerned about the arrests that are happening in Moscow at the moment. And this is could be the one area in their talks where there will be a bit of disagreement. The French president is, of course, very aware of what's going on in Moscow, is very aware in particular of what's happening in the legal system. And let's not forget that just last week, a Russian court released from prison a French businessman who had been in custody. Indeed, yes, he is now only under house arrest, but the French government had been in touch with the Russian officials about that. So Russia won't be getting off lightly, but so it will be interesting to see how much of an emphasis Emmanuel Macron puts on those arrests and those continuing pro-democracy rallies that we're seeing in Moscow.
All right, that is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Thanks for being with us. U.S. President Donald Trump and top White House officials are dismissing concerns that economic growth may be faltering. Speaking to reporters Sunday, Trump said he sees little risk of recession despite a volatile week on the global bond markets.
I don't see a recession. I mean, the world is in a recession right now. And although that's too big a statement, but if you look at China, China's doing very, very poorly.
He also insisted that the trade war with China is not economically hurting Americans.
We're doing tremendously well. Our consumers are rich. I gave a tremendous tax cut, and they're loaded up with money.
But in an interview with ABC's This Week, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat running for president, says President Trump's trade actions show he is out of touch with regular people.
I don't think his worldview is reflected in the everyday kitchen table issues that families are facing. They're worried about their jobs. They're worried about access to health care. They're worried about providing for their kids.
Well, joining us to talk more about the rising concern over the U.S. and global economy is Peter Drysdale, head of the Asia Bureau of Economic Research at the Australian National University. Thank you so much for being with us. What are you seeing in terms of the big picture here?
Well, I think we've been concerned about that prospect for some time. Of course, the U.S. looks as if it's doing pretty well at this stage, and it is. The tax cuts have provided a short-term stimulus to the economy, but that's not sustainable over time, and it's not consistent with policy objectives to keep the economy in balance, including the current account in balance, and consistent with the sustainability of public debt. And more than that, the trade war between the U.S. and China has now shaken global confidence very badly. And we've been looking at that closely because you know how dependent Australia is on the regional economy, including on China, with over three quarters of our external economic relations really focused on this region. And the whole region's now nervous about the fracture of confidence in global investors.
President Trump just said that his administration is not yet ready for a trade deal with China. Do you believe that the longer this goes on, the more likely we will see real damage?
It depends how it goes on, of course, Laurie. I guess if there was a retreat from the trade measures that have already been taken and pause or truce in the trade war in a substantive way that would alleviate uncertainties. But whatever happens in this trade war, there's not a happy outcome. And that's because when a deal's done, if a deal is done, whenever it is, even if it's quite a way off, it's going to be a deal that does damage to the multilateral global trading system. And people are more and more deeply worried about that. It's taken a time to realize the severity of it, but the markets have not been reluctant to make the judgment about it. And that's why you've seen a very big fall, a 20% fall in international direct investment over the last year or so. And that's reflective of this fracture of global investor confidence.
So when you talk about things that could really be detrimental, what specifically do you see potentially happening if this drags on?
Well, if it drags on, well, we've already got a drag on trade and a weakening of trade, of course, directly between the United States and China. But that also produces uncertainties about confidence in the whole system because, you know, this is not just a trade war between New Zealand and Australia or somewhere. This is a trade war between the two largest economies and the two largest traders in the world. And that inevitably damages the whole system. And our calculations of the effect of that is a hit to global GDP of 5% or so. It's not trivial if it goes on as it's promised to go on. Now, if there's a retreat from that, we can wind back. But even a retreat from it is going to involve a deal of some type which actually offends all the rules upon which the global system is currently organized and on which our trade prosperity with Asia totally depends. So there's a big problem here. And it's not going to be easy to resolve, and it's going to take time to resolve. So I think the wise heads in policy, but also obviously in the market, playing cautious, very cautious. They're very nervous, and that will impact on the prospects not only for the global economy, but also for the U.S. economy.
President Trump said that this is costing China a fortune, but it is not impacting Americans. Would you say that is an accurate statement?
It's obviously not totally accurate. There are a number of sectors on the production side that are directly affected by the trade war in the United States, in the farm sector in particular. But also the big effect in the United States is ultimately upon consumers and the price effects of higher cost products to consumers in the United States, I think, are beginning to show through now. And I think the president acknowledged that in a recent tweet about explaining the delay he might put on the imposition of punitive tariffs because a delay might alleviate the burden of the trade war on U.S. consumers over Christmas. Well, there's a certain inconsistency there that has to be confronted, and that means that it's not true to say that this doesn't damage both sides. It damages both sides, but what the bigger damage is, Laurie, is the damage to the whole global system, the United States' credibility in that system, and over time, that also impacts on U.S. economic potential.
Nobody can say for sure what the future holds, but I know economists can get some pretty good indicators. Would you say that it's more likely than not that the U.S. and potentially countries around the world will be seeing another recession in the near future?
Well, I think the probabilities of that are high, and they're reflected in the move to cash around the world now. And we're not insulated from that. We're going to be hit hard by it. So I think the probabilities of a recession in the next year to 18 months are very high now.
That's Peter Drysdale. He's the head of the Asia Bureau of Economic Research at the Australian National University. Violence was largely averted in Portland, Oregon, Sunday, where police established concrete barriers, closed streets and bridges, and seized a multitude of weapons to preempt clashes between right-wing groups and anti-fascist counter-protesters Saturday. But at least 13 people were arrested, and the protesters vowed to return to the West Coast city.
The city of Portland, Oregon. On edge this weekend as a right-wing rally descends on the downtown area.
USA! USA!
Showing up to greet them, more than 1,000 counter-protesters, including masked members of the local Antifa. Portland police say no major violent incidents took place. The Bureau reported 13 arrests and several minor injuries, and the far-right groups left the city relatively fast. But as Portland sees a rising number of these public far-right gatherings, the city's mayor says authorities are grappling with a changing environment.
We are now confronting the reality that in the United States, we have a rising white nationalist movement based on white supremacy in this country, and it is impacting the entire nation. But we're certainly seeing that play out here on the streets of Portland.
Saturday's rally saw a few hundred right-wing demonstrators, including members of the white supremacist group Proud Boys. Their choice to converge in Portland, they say, is a show of force.
I believe in anybody's right to exist on a public park, a sidewalk, anywhere. I mean, that should be our right. It's a God-given right to be able to do that, right? And so it's very important to stand up for that.
After the election of President Donald Trump, a host of far-right groups began to more publicly emerge.
Four more years!
Along with a strong tradition of protest, the city of Portland has now become a flashpoint for standoffs between the far right and left.
For a long time, conservatives kept their mouths shut. And so that's what this is about, especially coming to Portland. Like, this is the most liberal city in the country.
Right-wing leaders vowed to return in the future, they say, so long as Antifa remains active in the city. For VOA News, I'm Deborah Bloom in Portland, Oregon.
And you are listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, French wines are also thought to be, are often thought to be some of the best in the world, but you wouldn't normally associate the fruit of the vine with monks and monasteries. But 15 minutes by ferry from the celebrity-congested city of Cannes, a small island with 16 centuries of history, is inhabited exclusively by monks who are producing award-winning wines. Reporter Amy Gutman recently visited the island and joins us to talk more about this unique place. Amy, I understand the vineyard dates back to the Middle Ages. This whole story is really fascinating.
It's fascinating, especially because so few people know about this tiny island, and it's got a sister island as well that's just about a mile away. You can in fact swim between the two of them. And so just off the coast of Cannes, this glamorous, glitzy, super mega yacht filled place with designer labels and of course host to the annual film festival, sits these two small islands. Saint-Honorat is inhabited only by 21 Cistercian monks. They adhere to the vows of living modestly and on the fruits of their work. And on this island that they've occupied for 1,600 years, they produce wines and liquors, and the vineyards date back to the Middle Ages. But it wasn't until the 1990s that the monks relaunched commercial operations. And it was then that they discovered that they actually have five different micro terroirs on the island. So this is five different sort of almost microclimate, micro growing areas for different grapes. So some of the grapes that they're growing red and white grapes, including Syrah, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Viognier, and they're producing 40,000 bottles a year, all organic. And obviously the taste is quite unique because they've got limestone, which is magnesium rich. They've got marine rock. And of course they're on this island. So they have all this salt air that adds to this wine's special singularity, meaning special, very individualistic flavor and taste. And the wine is consumed in very few places. You can buy it on the island. You can also order it at a pretty hefty price tag. There's also a small restaurant on the opposite island where you can drink this wine. And then a couple of very high-end places on the mainland where you can order this wine. It's also been served at some of the fancy, glamorous dinners that are held during the Cannes Film Festival. during the G20 when it was held in France. The heads of state drank this wine.
I think it's fascinating that they're monks, and I imagine they don't drink, and yet they're producing this wine. But that aside, apparently the island and the abbey also have a pretty interesting history.
Well, they do. And of course, the island itself has been inhabited for 1,600 years. It was raided by pirates, with the monks taken hostage. And then it changed from Benedictine monks who occupied this island to Cistercian monks. The monastery was closed by the French king in the middle of the 18th century when there were just a few monks left. Then the island was nationalized during the French Revolution, and the monastery ultimately was sold to an actress who lived there for 20 years. Now, later, a bishop bought the island, and following that purchase, Cistercian monks started a new community there and decided that it had the ideal climate for growing vines to make wine. And then, of course, more than a century later, the abbot took the decision to commercialize the production, and they sent someone over to Bordeaux. Obviously, France has an incredible heritage in winemaking, and they sent this person over to the mainland, to Bordeaux, where he learned winemaking techniques and brought those techniques back with him to the island.
He's waiting for me outside now. He's hovering, so we've got to hurry.
Okay, just ask me if people can visit the island.
So can people actually visit the island?
People can visit the island. In fact, I visited the island. It's open to the public, and the vineyard hosts tours once a month. And even more than that, you can apply to go and stay in the monastery on a personal retreat. You pay what you want, but you do have to apply, and you're expected to bring your own sheets, your own towels, and help with tasks like setting and clearing the tables for meals, which, by the way, are eaten in silence. Okay. I did not eat in silence, but I did visit the island, which was very peaceful and a perfect juxtaposition to the glamour and glitz of Cannes.
All right, that is Europe-based reporter Amy Gutman. Thanks for talking to us today. Fans of Duane Allman in Macon, Georgia, say they did not expect the late musician's old guitar to sell for $1.25 million at a recent auction. The gold-topped guitar is the one Allman played in the hit song Layla when he performed with Eric Clapton. Until recently, the guitar, affectionately called Layla, had been on display at the Allman Brothers Band Museum at the Big House in Macon. Museum director Richard Brent said the guitar's history is what sold it for that huge amount. He said the man who bought the guitar at the auction is an out-of-town collector who wishes to remain anonymous. Duane Allman played the guitar on the first two Allman Brothers records and in Lonely a Dime with Boz Scaggs. But recording Layla with Derek and the Dominoes is among the last times Allman played that guitar. You have been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. And thank you very much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Hey!
This is VOA.